From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about showbiz with someone who was born into it, Carrie Fisher. Also, a recipe for blood, stage blood that is, from special effects makeup artist Tom Savini. He created gruesome effects for Dawn of the Dead and Friday the 13th, and he directed a remake of George Romero's classic Night of the Living Dead. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews a box set reissue from the vaults of Stax, the soul label that defined the Memphis sound with such artists as Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Wilson Pickett. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Representatives of the European Community have voted to continue pressuring the Yugoslav government and the breakaway republics of Croatia and Slovenia to adopt an EC peace accord. The European leaders also voted to send delegations to monitor the situation inside the troubled country. The BBC's Stephen Jessel reports from The Hague in the Netherlands.
The foreign ministers agreed to send two missions to Yugoslavia, the first made up of three community foreign ministers, the so-called Troika, to help in the search for a political solution. The second mission of senior officials from the same three states will set up arrangements for a group of monitors to be drawn from several community states, which will help stabilize the ceasefire and oversee the agreement reached by the various parties in Yugoslavia. Various steps were agreed, including an arms embargo and the suspension of financial aid. Some states wanted to make it clear that any further military action by the Yugoslav army would lead to the recognition of Slovenia. But the final communique said only that the community would reconsider its policy if the ceasefire were breached, in particular if there were unilateral military action.
The BBC's Stephen Jessel. The Russian parliament has given conditional approval to Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's new Treaty of Union. The treaty was approved after Russian President Boris Yeltsin appealed to lawmakers to support it. Yeltsin said that rejection of the accord could mean the political collapse of the Soviet Union. In the end, Russian delegates added amendments to the treaty that could ultimately kill it. They called for the republics to control their own taxation and foreign trade, two areas that the central government doesn't want to let go of. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was closed down by federal authorities earlier this year after it was implicated in laundering money for deposed Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega, has now had its operations suspended in Britain, Luxembourg, and the Cayman Islands. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
The Bank of England says it has evidence that the Luxembourg-based Bank of Credit and Commerce International has been involved in widespread fraud over a number of years, which could be on an unprecedented scale. The UK assets of BCCI have been placed in liquidation, and deposits in Britain and Luxembourg totaling $7.4 billion have been seized. Investors arriving at the bank's 25 UK branches today were met by closed doors.
I have £250,000 in this bank, and I find the bank closed, and I have not money for tomorrow, you know.
BCCI was founded in 1972, and it rapidly expanded to become one of the biggest privately quoted banks, noted particularly for its third world operations. Today's action does not affect the US banks in which BCCI has a controlling interest. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost just over 2 points. This is NPR News. The brain-damaged woman who is at the center of a right-to-live controversy in Minnesota died last night of natural causes. Helen Wangley was 87. She'd been in a persistent vegetative state since May of last year, and doctors wanted to disconnect her life support systems. They were opposed by the woman's husband, Oliver Wangley, who said that unplugging her respirator would amount to euthanasia. Doctors then asked the court to appoint an independent conservator to decide Mrs. Wangley's fate. The judge ruled earlier this week that Oliver Wangley was competent to make decisions about his wife's medical care. As expected, Major League Baseball owners have voted to allow two new members into their exclusive club. Starting in 1993, there'll be Big League Baseball in Denver and Miami. Steve Inskeep has more.
In a conference call with Baseball Commissioner Faye Vincent this afternoon, the owners voted by acclamation to approve expansion of the National League. A committee had previously picked the two cities from among several competitors. The owners are said to like the Miami franchise because a single owner will control it, multimillionaire Wayne Huizenga. Officials in Denver credit their success to being in an untapped market, hundreds of miles from any other big league team. Denver lawmakers are hiking the sales tax to raise money for a new stadium, a $100 million investment they say they'll make back when the ball club starts to bring in new business. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New York.
Unemployment was up slightly in June, boosting the civilian jobless rate to 7%, the highest it's been in nearly 5 years. According to the Labor Department, that translates to 8.7 million people out of work. Almost 2 million of those people have lost their jobs since the beginning of the recession last July. At the same time, the number of people applying for new state unemployment benefits was down slightly for the week ending June 22nd. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Carrie Fisher, is featured in the new comedy Soap Dish as a sex-crazed casting director. Carrie Fisher grew up the daughter of famous parents and an infamous divorce. The family was in the headlines when her father, Eddie Fisher, left her mother, Debbie Reynolds, for Elizabeth Taylor. The notoriety didn't stop Carrie Fisher from getting into show business herself. She starred as Princess Leia in 3 Star Wars films, but her career stumbled. She was getting parts in second-rate films, and she developed a drug habit that landed her in a rehabilitation center. But things changed after rehab. Her acting career was revitalized by When Harry Met Sally. She played Meg Ryan's best friend. And Fisher's semi-autobiographical 1987 novel, Postcards from the Edge, was a bestseller. At the same time her second novel, Surrender the Pink, was published, a film version of Postcards from the Edge was released, with a screenplay by Fisher. It recently came out on video. Postcards from the Edge is the story of a young actress trying to restart her film career after getting out of rehab. She gets plenty of unwanted advice from her domineering mother, an aging musical comedy star. Shirley MacLaine plays the mother, Meryl Streep the daughter. I asked Fisher why she didn't star in the film.
It never occurred to me. First of all, if I could have the choice between me and Meryl Streep as who would be the actress in anything, I would go for Meryl Streep. And I don't think I would have been able to carry that film. So it's not like Stallone writing Rocky, you know. I think it's a film that would be perceived as being far more autobiographical than it actually is. And me mixing myself up into that will then turn it into an apparent documentary.
Right. You've been in a lot of films, and now you've had the chance to write dialogue for others. You've written some very funny lines for people. Have there been lines you've had to read during your career that you didn't think quite worked, that you really wanted to rewrite?
General Kenobi, years ago you served my father in the Clone Wars. I have begged you to help me. I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. My father will know how to retrieve it, okay? We used to say to him, you can type this stuff, but you can't say it. Yeah, I have tons of stuff that, you know, seems like it's a well-constructed sentence, but it is not how people talk. It's how people write. So that's why I think it's sometimes easier for me to write for actors, because I know what's frustrating about, so, you know, sentences that come out just perfect. Well, who talks like that? And who of us don't overlap each other? Except on the radio, hopefully.
Now, you not only have a new movie, but you have a new book, and the book is called Surrender the Pink. And in the back of the book, you have acknowledgments. One of them reads, I would like to thank my mother for being such a good sport about what people think apropos of what I write. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, meaning that she not only had to sit through my book where she said to me after reading it, she said, well, you know, dear, people are going to think that this is you. Meaning people are going to think this is her daughter taking a lot of drugs and actually in excess of what I had I had friends who knew me well that after that book said, I didn't know you shot heroin. So I think it's a trivializing tribute to the plausibility of a lot of the way that I write. And also in the movie now, you know, the character of the mother is, I don't know what is sort of like, is drinks a couple of times and the daughter thinks that she's an alcoholic, but I wrote that intending it to be that If I had moved in with the Pope after I got out of the rehab, I would have thought he was an alcoholic because of the wine every day. I mean, that's how I thought. And I don't really believe the mother is an alcoholic in this. And that's not based on anything current or true in my life, but I know it will be, you know, thought, because the movie is so well done, that my mother and I shriek at each other on stairways. After she saw it, she said she thought the fight scene was so good that she thought we could find a nice stairway and try it out. But we actually, you know, fought when I was a teenager, which I think is a more appropriate time. And we were so upset by the fighting that we haven't repeated it.
What kinds of things did you fight about?
Well, she had like a breakdown when I was about 15. A lot of different, you know, what you fight about is, no, I don't want to go to that school you want me to. You know, I want to do this. No, you can't. Yes, I will. But she had a nervous breakdown at that time. And so some of the fighting was, I thought she should leave my stepfather, who had lost all his money and hers and humiliated her in various other ways. And I used to just berate her. I must have been a horrible child. I wasn't a comfort. I was an accuser. And I used to just tell her that she should leave Harry But her breakdown never manifested in actually breaking down, or there was no nervousness attached to it. She would drink, and she did a show. She did a Broadway show for a year, and she lost a lot of weight, and that's all that ever happened. But in my mind as a teenager, I urgently required that she be all right, because I didn't have any other parent.
Let me read the acknowledgement about your father in the book. You thank your father for that Jewish thing.
Well, that's actually something my mother always... when she thinks that I'm just this little extra bit upset, which she attributes to, that's that Jewish thing, dear.
So do you feel, your mother was what, Protestant?
Nazarene, actually. She's from Texas, where she was kicked out of the church for becoming an actress and asked back in for becoming a movie star.
Carrie Fisher is my guest. Your new novel, Surrender of the Pink, is about a woman named Dinah who's going through a rough period because her ex-husband has a new girlfriend, and that's making Dinah very unhappy. In fact, she even hides in the closet one day and eavesdrops on the conversation of her ex and his current lover. And what she finds out is that this woman is really like living and breathing to take care of him, you know, spending all her time cooking up these fabulous recipes and so on. I'm wondering if you've seen that happen a lot in show business, that men end up seeking out women who are just going to be their helpmates
I mean, you could see where if you're having a gigantic job, which a lot of these powerful men that I know do have, then what they really, it would be nice to have a counterpart, meaning somebody who was literally your mental peer. And so you had all these dazzling conversations and you know, debates and so forth. But really, I think a lot of them, you know, it's the difficulty of knowing whether you want a companion or a counterpart. Do you want to be soothed or stimulated? And if you're so stimulated by your career, then basically it would be probably best if a woman soothed you. I mean, the ideal would be to have an intellectual geisha, someone who provided both. But I think that's a contradiction in terms.
Carrie Fisher, you were probably photographed since you were born because you were the daughter of famous parents. How did that affect how you feel felt about being on camera?
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it. I really don't like it. I don't like my face. I don't like to look at it. And I just can't get past it. That's why I say I would rather not watch myself in movies. I enjoy the experience, but I won't really see the film until they're on cable deep on into my life so I can pretend it's someone else at another time.
What are some of your memories of these press sessions as a kid when you were, you know, daughter of famous Hollywood
celebs? They don't ask you anything. You just had to stay out of the living room and not, you know, make too much noise because Mommy was having a meeting.
Were you ever, though, the adorable child that had to be on camera?
Just in those sort of parades and stuff and at Christmas and what have you. And a lot of, my mother liked to take a lot of pictures of everything. We had leather-bound books of every birthday, leather Christmas. I used to just really sulk dramatically, as a Hollywood child might be wont to do. This is the biggest power struggle my mother and I had. My biggest rebellion was finally getting out of some Christmas shots once. I just felt it was just too intense to continuously be documenting our lives in this way. But that's, she liked to do it, and she'd gotten used to it. I just didn't like it.
You also didn't have a career that it was going to help.
I had her career. I was part of her career. That's, you know, that's, it's part of the thing. They take home shots, particularly in those days. You know, that was like Debbie and her family. And then when my parents divorced, they took all those, like, spying shots. Debbie's tragedy, Debbie sobbing over children. And I always just look really like someone who will someday be on prescription medication. No, I look sort of panicked and jostled. I look like, you know, caught in the headlights.
You look back at those pictures now?
Do you, I mean,
do you have scrapbooks
sobbing,
of this stuff in it?
Every night,
yeah,
every
right,
night,
right.
Drinking and drinking and looking through these scrapbooks.
No, but really, do you have them anywhere? Do you have these
somewhere?
Pictures?
I only come upon them every time. I remember one evening I found stuff at the beach, and some fan had sent my mother a scrapbook of the whole divorce thing, which I have no memory of. I was two. And there was all this stuff in it about Elizabeth and what she said at the time. Well, you can't really break up a happy marriage. And I remember at whatever age I was then, which was like 23, I was pissed. I thought, you know what? The classier thing to do, babe, is just don't say anything.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's true, but you don't come out and say stuff like that. So it's like when people ask me what I felt about her at the time, nothing. But at 23, I had a little bit of a thing where I thought, oh, really?
Have you seen her since then?
We don't really correspond. Yes, I have seen her at a party. But you know, someone came up to me at a party once and said, Elizabeth is very upset that you haven't come and said hello. And I thought, Elizabeth is upset that I haven't come? You know, like, what is our relationship? So I was summoned. So I went up to her and I sang, we have so much in common. And whatever else ensued, it was this inane exchange.
Oh, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And Carrie Fisher is my guest, and she wrote the screenplay for the new movie adaptation of her novel, Postcards from the Edge. It's directed by Mike Nichols, stars Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine. Fisher also has a new novel called Surrender the Pink. This is Fresh Air. Carrie Fisher is my guest. Do you feel that you're getting different kinds of roles now in your acting career?
I'm playing the friend now.
Uh-huh.
I'm going through my friendly phase.
Well, you were certainly that in When Harry Met Sally.
And I've just done a film called Drop Dead Fred with Phoebe Cates, and I play her friend. And I was a very good friend to her.
Did nearly ODing and then recovering from your drug habit change the kind of acting you wanted to do or the way people perceived you who were casting you?
I don't get any really, like, loaded roles, you mean? I don't... No, I had a bad reputation of somebody who might get stoned on a movie. And so I just... That kind of went away, you know. But it takes a long time. I mean, they still ask at insurance companies who have to, you know, cover the film, right? And if somebody gets sick or whatever, they have to pay. And they will not cover you for drugs and alcohol. And if you have a history of doing drugs or having abused drugs and alcohol or being in rehab, they can ask you for screens. And I don't mean Japanese silk screens. And they actually, as recently as a year ago, you know, asked, well, is she all right? Is she, you know, still going to AA or something? So it tends to cling to you.
Mm-hmm. Did you start your career performing with your mother in her club act?
Yes.
So you were doing song and dance stuff?
Dance, no. I dance like my father, but I break just like a little girl. I sang in her act. Well, actually, there was a little humiliating dancing, and I'm still in therapy to correct that, and taking antibiotics. But I did that from 13 to, say, 17. And then I went to drama college. The last fight that I had with my mother was over that. She insisted that I go, and at that point I wanted to be a nightclub singer.
No, what kind of songs were you singing in the act?
If I loved you, you know, I have a big Broadway voice, or, you know, a medium Broadway voice.
You know, your appearance hits included Tammy for your mother, Debbie Reynolds, and Oh Mein Papa, Dungaree Doll for your father, Eddie Fisher. These were the songs in a way that rock and roll was rebelling against. You know, did you relate to their songs?
Sure, I married Paul Simon. I rebelled against that. Yeah, I like those songs. There's beautiful songs. My father, particularly, he had Count Your Blessings. When I'm tired and I can't sleep, I count my blessings instead of sheep. It's so sweet. Irving Berlin. And They're Not Painting the Skies as Blue This Year, Wish You Were Here. I mean, really nice. My mother had one that was Am I That Easy to Forget? Really tuneful, like, they say you found somebody new, but I don't want no one but you. You know, stuff that, like, Ronstadt could do covers of these older types of songs, which she has, and they're great. I mean, I just think that there's a line drawn between the generations, but I don't think... There was a point when I was doing her act, and I was singing those kinds of songs, and I thought, when I was high on marijuana one night... I don't listen to music like this, therefore I must stop doing this stuff in the show.
And is that when you stopped?
Yeah, I sang Bridge Over Troubled Water. If I don't have a weird life, I don't know who does.
Your first movie role was in Shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
And you were, what, 17?
Yes.
And you play the daughter of a woman who's having an affair with Warren Beatty, one of the many affairs that he's having. And then you proposition him quite aggressively in the movie. So you were pretty young, 17. And in your new book, you have a line that goes, I'm not really fluent in sex. I speak it, but it's more a second language. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel that's speaking for you or not. But
oh, yes.
Well, what was it like for you at 17 to, you know,
becoming... Say that line. I was a virgin. And Warren, of course, so lovely, informed the entire crew. So that there is, when you see the film, they cut instantly after the line because the entire crew would burst out laughing. Because there I am saying, you want to, and, you know, I didn't know what I was referring to, in fact. So it was, you know, I had no sense memory to draw on.
What was your audition like for Star Wars?
I like to say that I was sitting in Schwab's with that ridiculous hairstyle and George Lucas walked in. There's no good story to it. You know, I knew Fred Roos, who was the casting director. I was going to drama college in England by then, and I came back, and they did a video of me reading maybe alone and then with Harrison. And that's, you know, and they did two of those, and I was selected out of it was a very long process, but they sort of hired us as a trio.
You actually went to school for professional children, right?
What does that mean, though? And we're, as opposed to amateurish
right.
children.
Well, it's for children who are working,
you get
though,
paid for being children. I was only there temporarily. I dropped out of that school. So that, or slid. I went course by course in the 11th grade. So I am a high school dropout. And I like to say that writing is perfect karma for a high school dropout in that I have homework now for the rest of my life.
In Postcards from the Edge, the mother who's a famous performer wants her daughter to sing. And I was wondering if this ever happened with you. I know you sang in your mother's act.
My mother wants me to sing. My grandmother wants it more.
Wants you to sing more?
Yeah, but you know what my mother said after seeing the movie? She said, well, dear, now you don't have to sing.
Oh, because you can write so well.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, your parents want you to do sort of what the... And it's really a testimony to her enjoying what she does so much. But I was always panicked to go into the same field because she inhabited it so successfully, you know, and I couldn't do it. And I have stage fright. She does not. She has incredible poise and, you know, mastery over the moment. And I have to really overcome a lot of fear. And I end up being good. I mean, I can do, in a way, what my mother does. I can be chatty and spirited and, you know, whatever it is that's required on talk shows or on a stage. But it costs me something that I can't spend that often. And it doesn't cost my mother that. She really loves it.
Do you sing anymore?
No. I mean, I never... Yeah, okay, I did when I was a teenager. But I did a lot of things as a teenager that I'm ashamed of.
What's the difference in Hollywood now between when your mother was making movies and now when you're making movies?
Oy.
I mean, anything you miss, you know, that you wish you had?
There were women's roles. They made careers for you. They wrote scripts for both men and women. You could, you know, have a career that you were under contract to a studio and they gave you 3 movies a year to do. The bad news about that was you had to do them good or bad, but the good news was you were always employed. They promoted you. Now you have to hire your own publicist. You have to go out and hustle your own movies and get an agent and a manager and a... And there's, you know, 29% of the roles in movies now are for women. So, yeah, I think that's bad. And the women's roles after 40 are under 5%, which means it follows the same lines as procreation. As our eggs die, so do our careers.
So which direction do you plan to be heading in more, writing or acting?
Well, I think I better write because in about 7 or 8 years, my eggs are going to be on the griddle. And as a writer, they can't limit me that way.
One last thing. You watched your parents live out their lives in public, and especially when your father, Eddie Fisher, left your mother, Debbie Reynolds. It was a really big story for a really long time. Has that made you especially uncomfortable about having a public relationship?
Well, obviously not, because I had one.
Well, you had it with a public person, with Paul Simon, but I don't know how much it was played out in public.
Well, I mean, there's some of that. You know, it's like you're repelled and drawn to. I mean, look, I really pretty much repeated my mother's life in that way. I mean... Strange. I went into movies the same age she went into movies. I had the same first agent. I became a star at the same age. And I married a popular, small Jewish singer. And it was also a disaster. I suppose fortunately or unfortunately, we didn't have children. But that's kind of... So if I certainly haven't shied away from my mother's life. If anything, I've, you know, really studied the blueprint.
Did Paul Simon run away with an Elizabeth Taylor type?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I'm sure he's sorry to report. Unless he's with Elizabeth McGovern or something now. Hey, that's an idea.
Well, Carrie Fisher, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You know, actually, the good thing is Elizabeth is available, so maybe, I don't know. Let me make a couple of calls.
All right.
All right, nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Actress and novelist Carrie Fisher. You can see her in the comedy Soap Dish. Postcards from the Edge, the movie based on her novel, is out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Savini built his reputation creating gruesome movie scenes, zombies munching on human thighs, and axes cutting into human heads. He's the wizard of special effects makeup, who worked on all George Romero's horror films, with the exception of Night of the Living Dead. But Savini made up for that by directing a new version of the film. Coming up, a lesson in transforming out-of-work actors into flesh-eating zombies. Also, the Memphis Sound. Ed Ward reviews a new reissue of records from the soul label Stax, the label that brought us Otis Redding, Carla Thomas, Sam and Dave, and Booker T and the MGs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, officials in Slovenia say that there are continuing efforts to comply with demands of the federal government, which had set a deadline of midnight last night for some of them. The country's information minister gave details of how some of the troops are being sent home. Jim Fish filed this report for the BBC.
By standing down nearly 10,000 of its troops, Slovenia has made a conciliatory gesture towards the federal authorities, whose demands and deadlines they originally rejected as impossible. A second demand for the release of all Yugoslav army prisoners is in the process of being met, as hundreds of prisoners have been assembled throughout the day in Ljubljana prior to their eventual return home by train. On the question of Slovenia's borders, however, there seems to be little movement. The federal authorities want to regain control over customs and border facilities, whereas the Slovene presidency is calling for negotiations involving the European community. The federal authorities demanded the restoration of the borders to their previous status by this Sunday. It was the Yugoslav army's attempt to seize control of the main border crossing posts last week, which led to the outbreak of fighting.
Jim Fish reporting for the BBC. In Washington, the government said today that the nation's jobless rate rose to 7% last month, its highest level in nearly 5 years. Some 8.7 million Americans were out of work in June. But the Bush administration says that the U.S. economy is now on the rebound. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from the White House.
President Bush's chief economic advisor, Michael Boskin, says the administration is not satisfied by the rise in unemployment, but Boskin says the economic recovery has begun. He said unemployment tends to lag behind the turnaround in other sections of the economy, such as production and sales. Boskin predicts that unemployment levels will drop later on in the year. Economists outside the administration are divided over the significance of the continuing rise in jobless levels. Some say they indicate the recovery may be stalling. Others, more optimistic, say businesses are cautious about hiring new workers immediately after going through a downturn. On the plus side, the government said today the length of the average work week increased again, indicating production is up as well. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Canada's unemployment rate climbed to 10.5% last month, back up to its highest point last spring. The number of people out of work in Canada is now 1,453,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 2 points to close at 2,932.47 on volume of only 70 million shares. It was the lowest volume of the year. This is NPR News. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has told the UN that his country will turn over a list of nuclear materials and make sure that UN inspectors have access to nuclear sites. This word from the Iraqi president was received in New York City as a special commission told the UN Security Council that UN inspection teams in Iraq were not given the help that was needed. Under an April ceasefire resolution, Iraq is to give up its weapons of mass destruction. In Europe, the German upper house of parliament has voted to stay in bond for an indefinite period of time. Deidre Berger has more.
In the future, the German parliament will be divided between the new capital of Berlin and the former capital of Bonn. Last month, the Bundestag, the lower house of parliament, voted after an emotional debate to move to Berlin. The upper house, the Bundesrat, decided after 2 days of discussions to stay in the provincial post-war capital of Bonn in an attempt to maintain the city's reputation as a government center. The Bundesrat left open the option of a later move to Berlin if the logistics of a split parliament become too complicated. The Bonn government has not yet decided which ministries and government institutions will be moved to Berlin. The Bonn city government hopes to attract new European institutions to partially replace the loss of the federal German structure. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Officials say that Germany's current financial picture has moved further into the red, upping chances that the country will have a deficit this year. If that happens, it will be the first time since 1981. However, one leading economist in Germany said that the mark's rise against the U.S. dollar and better economic reports are likely to boost exports in the second half of the year. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Tom Savini is a wizard of special effects makeup. Gore is his specialty. If you need to show a victim with an axe in his skull, a young man splitting his arm open with a razor, or a zombie gnawing on a human thigh, Savini is your man. He did special effects makeup for Friday the 13th, Maniac, and Creepshow. He did the makeup effects for George Romero's zombie films Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. The only Romero film he didn't work on was Romero's first film, the 1968 horror classic Night of the Living Dead. But last year, Savini directed a remake of Night of the Living Dead, with Romero serving as co-writer and executive producer. Dawn of the Dead, the first sequel to Night of the Living Dead, was set in a shopping mall, the place the Walking Dead instinctively return to after they rise from their graves. The scenes of zombies feasting on human flesh are far more graphic in the sequel than in the original. I asked Savini if that was his intention.
When I first saw Night of the Living Dead, you know, as an effects guy, I thought that the zombies, the makeups, the effects could have been a lot more sophisticated, more state-of-the-art. What George did was I think George was actually doing the effects on the film. He was using chocolate syrup for blood and mortician's wax for makeups and having to do everything, you know, that I think that suffered. So in Dawn of the Dead, clearly here's an opportunity, and it was a color film, to do something, I guess we went overboard, more graphic because of how primitive I thought the first film was. I mean, we would sit around thinking about, you know, how to kill people. I mean, that was our daily, you know, our exercise. And we would go to George and say, how about if we took a screwdriver and drove it in a guy's ear? And he would say, okay, you know, and we would just go do it a couple hours later. So it was like Halloween for 3 months, you know, and it was like anything we wanted to do, George would let us do. And I think because it was released unrated, everything stayed in.
Oh, rather than take the X, you released it unrated so you could get
That's
as graphic
what he did,
as
yeah.
you wanted to. I'd like to hear more about the makeup that you used for it. It's a movie with a lot of blood. What do you like to use for blood? What's the most realistic-looking blood?
Well, I'm embarrassed about the blood in Dawn of the Dead. It looked like melted crayons. It was terrible. It was a 3M company used to make a blood called 3M Blood. You know, sometimes it looked good. Most of the time, though, like I said, it looked like melted crayons. The best blood is Dick Smith's formula. Dick Smith is the god of makeup artists, the Godfather, the Sentinel, Midnight Cowboy, Taxi Driver. You know, it goes on and on and on. His formula is basically Cairo corn syrup, red and yellow food coloring, a preservative, and a wetting agent. His is the blood used throughout. Every makeup artist uses his formula.
So you use his formula most of the time now?
Yeah, but not in Dawn of the Dead. Right after that, Friday the 13th, all the other films after that, I used Dick Smith's formula.
What kind of special makeup or casting or whatever did you use when people were eating other people's limbs?
Well, most of that was sausage and bologna and chicken with some kind of a blood-colored barbecue sauce, you know, or anything that they might have at craft services that day we would throw in, you know, have them chewing on it.
Tom Savini is my guest, and he's been called, what, King of Splatter, King of Gore? Is
that let's see. Let's get it straight. God of Gore, King right. of Splatter, Splatter King, Wizard of Gore, Demented Sick, you know.
And so on.
Take your pick.
No, you've directed the updating of Night of the Living Dead. You weren't around when the original was made. You were actually... In Vietnam, if I have the story straight, you had met George Romero right before the movie, but you had already enlisted and...
Right, I enlisted in the Army on the hold program, which means they have 140 days. You can be called in within 140 days. So I met George Romero. We talked about doing the film. I showed him my portfolio, and he was all, you know, I would have worked on the film. But they called me in, and I was in the Army and in Vietnam when he really filmed it.
So you were a combat photographer in Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
So that means that you were seeing the real thing, I mean, in terms of gore and violence. And what was your visceral reaction to having to photograph the wounded?
Well, it was a visceral reaction. I think everybody who I came in contact with over there who was experiencing that, most of us were able to turn off our emotions. It became necessary to turn off the emotions. Those that didn't were in big trouble, emotionally, mentally. It's not something that's easy to do. I think your body, you know, if you're in an accident, your body, you go into shock and your body takes over and tries to protect you. I think your mind does the same thing in that situation. My mind took over, turned off my emotions, and I was able to look through the camera. Looking through the camera lens was also a help because through the lens, I could pretend and see it as special effects.
What kind of photographs were you called on to take when you were in Vietnam?
And I wasn't on the front lines, but if something happened, my job was to go in after a battle or a fracas and photograph damage to equipment and people.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to do movie versions of this after having seen real pain, after having seen the real suffering of it, and especially to do it in some of the movies that were, either more exploitative or more campy in their approach to it.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think I've ever gone in depth about talking about this sort of thing. But as you were saying that, I was thinking, okay, when I was there, I had to turn off my emotions. And when I got home, my emotions stayed turned off. It's not something that clicks back on so easily. It's almost like in Deer Hunter. Suddenly they're at the wedding and zoom, the very next frame, they're in Vietnam and they're in the middle of a fracas. And that's what it seemed like. I mean, I got on the plane, I went there, but suddenly, boom, my mind was there immediately. And then when I came home, it's the same thing. Boom, it was almost like I didn't remember getting there or I remember coming home. And my first marriage suffered. And I was divorced because of my Vietnam experience, I think, because I was emotionless when I came back. Suddenly, I think about a year later, I saw a sunset. And that marked, to me, the beginning of feeling something again.
Have you ever felt that you were not being true to the real suffering that you saw by recreating the suffering for movies?
Not being true to the real suffering. Well, if it was a Vietnam picture, then I would have some input. I think I would have to say if I thought something wasn't being filmed correctly, something that show what the way it really happened or what really went on. But in these horror fantasy films, you know, it's just a roller coaster ride, and it never really got that serious. Most people saw it for what it was, you know, fantasies and adventures. The films that dealt with films like Maniac or films that I'm actually afraid to watch, like Henry, the Portrait of a Serial Killer, things that deal with creeps who really exist out there, that's things that I don't want to see that stuff, you know. I want to go to a movie to escape, not to be reminded about the 6 o'clock news.
So you haven't seen Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer?
No. I cast
Tom
Cole.
You cast one of the co-stars in it, yeah.
I did. But I cast him mainly because of our conversations on the phone, the photographs he sent me. I knew I wanted Harry to be repugnant. And when I met Tom in New York and read him with other actresses, and also physically, he was the right type. He was balding. But the film itself, from what I hear, I'm just kind of afraid to watch it. It's not a music video on death. It's kind of a realistic portrayal, overly violent thing. It's a very subdued, from what they tell me, it makes me afraid to see it, you know.
My guest is special effects goremeister Tom Savini. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Tom Savini is my guest, and he's one of the wizards of special effects makeup. He's worked on all of George Romero's movies, with the exception of Night of the Living Dead, but now he has made a kind of updated remake of Night of the Living Dead. It's Tom Savini's debut as a director. You must have been pretty wacky as a kid, you know, when you started doing this, when you were still in your early teens, running around shopping for blood and pulling a lot of stunts, I'd imagine, in school and maybe in your family.
Well, obviously, when you do this sort of thing, the outlet for practical jokes increases, you know,
by leaps and bounds,
you know. And I was wacky as a kid. After I first saw that movie, Man of a Thousand Faces, I mean, I was shining shoes in my neighborhood to get money to buy makeup supplies. I lived and breathed makeup. I was reading everything I could about how they would... I asked my cousin one day, I said, how do they put the hair onto werewolves when they do that in a movie? And he said, spirit gum. Most people know what spirit gum is. It's a stage adhesive. I thought he said spearmint gum, okay? I'm 12 years old. So if you can imagine me chewing spearmint gum and trying, and this can't be right, you know. So I was trying to learn how to do this stuff. I would make up friends of mine, you know, with scars and burns and wounds. And, you know, a lot of times I would never be invited back to their homes, you know, their parents. No, I don't want that Savini kid around. He's crazy, you know.
Right. Can you explain how you create scars and wounds?
Ever since the silent movies, there's a chemical called collodion. It's a non-flexible plastic substance that you brush on. It's a liquid. And what it does is it attaches itself to your skin and then contracts. So if you remember Tom Berenger in Platoon, mm-hmm. or Donald Pleasance in the James Bond film where he played Dr. Blofeld, that deeply recessed impression of the skin is collodion. And if it's wounds and things, then, you know, you make a cast of the person's arm or face, wherever the wound is going to appear, and you actually sculpt, anatomically correct wounds and duplicate them in foam latex rubber, glue those on to the person's face or, you know, arm, whatever it is, color them, you know, the way they should be, paint them the way they should be, add the KY lubricating jelly for the sheen and the blood, and that's basically how to do it. But it actually depends on what the script calls for.
You really have to know a lot of techniques, both of art and medicine, probably. For instance, like when you're doing fangs, you have to cast somebody's teeth as if you were a dentist.
A special makeup technician today who was worth anything is a sculptor, a painter, a mold maker, has to know something about mechanics. He has to be a dental technician, a chemist, all the formulas for chemicals and for appliances and for rubber bladders, you know. You have to be somewhat of a psychologist because you're dealing with these actors all the time. I think you need to be a photographer for a sense of composition. It's so a sketch artist. It's so much. I get letters from people, kids, who are maybe 14 or 15, on stationery that says, Joe Blow, special makeup effects artist, and his stuff is very crude. He obviously knows nothing about the stuff. But I hang on to those photos because, you know, years later, I've hired people who started out that way and who have become really wonderful sculptors and makeup artists and mold makers. And most people who want to get into the business, I think they know from what they read that they have to know all that stuff.
Did you ever look at yourself in the mirror with one of your get-ups on and scare yourself?
No, I mainly get scared looking at myself when there's nothing on my face. Just my face, you know.
Special effects makeup wizard Tom Savini. The remake of Night of the Living Dead that he directed is out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up later on All Things Considered, Saddam Hussein says the United Nations may inspect Iraqi nuclear facilities they've been barred from until now. Also, today's news from Yugoslavia, Palestinians in the territories occupied by Israel rethink the Intifada. And in this year, the 75th anniversary year of the National Park Service, we learn that the park ranger's lot is not a happy one. A report from Howard Berkus coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Thank you.
The Stax and Vault record labels, based in Memphis, produced some of the greatest soul records of the 60s, including some songs you definitely won't hear on the oldie stations. But you can hear them all in a new collection recently released by Atlantic Records. Atlantic distributed Stax and Vault during their heyday, and rock and roll historian Ed Ward says he's glad Atlantic finally mined their archives to release this collection of gems.
Okay, rock and roll fans, I'm giving you 6 months' notice. This Christmas, what you're going to want to ask Santa for is the item your friendly neighborhood record store owner knows as the Stax Box. It consists of 9 compact discs with 244 tracks documenting every 45 RPM single put out by Stax and Vault Records in Memphis between 1959 and 1968. Every A-side is here, and quite a few significant B-sides. Obviously, it's got all the hits. Sam and Dave's Soul Man, Booker T and the MG's Green Onions, Otis Redding's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. But it's just got to have a lot of filler, right? Wrong.
I've been missing you for so many days. I keep wanting you, Lord, in so many ways. I can't get you off of my mind. But true love is so hard to find. I want it another day. Ooh, I need another day.
For one thing, there's a lot of stuff by famous people, like this obscure Otis Redding hit that nobody's heard in years. Then, there are absolute killers, like this Eddie Floyd number that died on release and have mainly been known to soul fanatics overseas. Also, original versions of songs that have become bar band classics in the hands of less talented performers, which come to life in a whole new way. Check out the horns on Mabel John's obscure classic here.
I don't have to beg you to hold me, 'cause somebody else will. About to come to an end.
That's scary, and the sound is perfect. Stax started out in the Satellite Record Shop on Macklemore Avenue in Memphis. They stayed there and recorded in the old movie theater next door until the company was sold to the Gulf and Western conglomerate in the late 60s. It was owned by two white people, Jim Stewart and his sister, Estelle Axton. But from the start, it was an integrated enterprise, sometimes in the most surprising ways. Both of the house bands, Booker T and the MGs and the Marquees, who were the horn section, were completely salt and pepper, although nearly all the records they did were soul and blues. The marquee on the converted movie theater read, Soulville, USA, and that's truth in advertising. It took me over a week to play through this astonishing collection, and one thing I thought of was what a similar Motown collection would have sounded like. After all, Motown and Stax were the Beatles and Stones of 60s soul. But although there was a house band, and there were also house songwriters at Stax, there was never a cut-and-dried formula the way there was at Motown. A Motown box like this would be boring, I think, with far fewer surprises. There was no overriding plan for world domination at Stax. They just wanted to make and sell some good records. Not all the records they cut were good, but very few of them were outright bad, and even the most off-the-cuff moments could be fun. Wendy Renee thought she was cutting a commercial for Leonard's, the famous Memphis barbecue joint, when she did that track. There's too much here to do justice to unless I hijack this station for at least the next couple of days, but I'll be exploring this set on future shows. You can count on that. Meanwhile, tell Santa to save up $100 or so you can enjoy this essential slice of American musical history. Or, if he can't wait, I won't mind. This music, like the barbecue Wendy Renee was singing about a moment ago, goes real well with hot summer days, too.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. From the Stax Box, here's Carla Thomas and Otis Redding.
Tramp.
What you call me?
Tramp.
You didn't.
You don't wear continental clothes or Stetson hats.
But I tell you one doggone thing, it makes me feel good to know one thing.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Where there is human suffering caused by war, famine, or natural disaster, you'll find Doctors Without Borders taking care of the sick and wounded. After the Gulf War, members of the group went to northern Iraq to care for the Kurdish refugees. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Dr. Ronnie Brauman, the president of Doctors Without Borders. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.